It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As archery and crossbow deer hunting season is set to get underway this weekend, the State Department of Natural Resources estimates almost 900 white-tailed deer have been found dead in the southeastern part of the state. Wisconsin is seeing its largest outbreak of a condition called epizootic hemorrhagic disease, or EHD. The DNR has confirmed deer deaths due to EHD in Washington, Ozaukee, and Waukesha counties. The disease isn't new to the state. It's been documented since at least 2002. That's according to DNR records. But this year's outbreak is significantly larger than in recent years. To get the latest, we're joined by Jasmine Batten, the DNR's Wildlife Health Section Supervisor. Jasmine, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
So first, set us up with, what are the signs of EHD?
Sure. EHD is a virus that's spread by small biting flies that affects hooved animals. So we're talking white-tailed deer, mostly in terms of our wildlife population here. It is a virus that kills many deer that it infects, although not all of them. And the deer that get infected get sick very quickly. You can't see a lot of signs outward. It's more inward hemorrhaging and other tissue damage, but they get a fever. They feel really sick. They often flock to water to relieve those symptoms and often die in a pond or a stream. So from the public's perspective, they might see deer that are lethargic or, you know, not moving as much as usual. But then we see a lot of dead deer on the landscape, especially near water sources.
So with the water, is that where they also pick up this disease?
So the small biting midges or flies, some people call them no-see-ums, that are able to spread the disease from deer to deer, breed in muddy flats. So it is just the insect bite that spreads the disease. And so when the deer come in contact with them, especially sometimes in drought conditions, you'll see more of that habitat. That's a bigger risk for an outbreak to happen.
And you mentioned this is in hooved animals. Just to be clear, this cannot spread to humans.
Absolutely. That's great news about it. Does not impact humans. It is known to infect cattle. However, on the domestic animal side, cattle often do not show signs of it and carry it asymptomatically.
What sets epizootic hemorrhagic disease apart from something like chronic wasting disease, also known as CWD, that we hear about?
Yeah, EHD is very different from CWD in a number of ways. Like I said, the EHD is a virus. We only see it episodically or periodically. So in Wisconsin, it's only really happened in a few locations, maybe every couple of years or so since 2012. The better thing about EHD than CWD is an outbreak of EHD tends to be relatively short-lived since it is spread by those insects. We usually see it in the late summer, early fall months, often continues to just after a heavy frost when those insects that are spreading the disease die for the season and transmission stops. The other good news about EHD is that deer populations typically recover quickly, even though we might see locally really devastating results or impacts in a season, such as what's happening in Washington, Waukesha County right now. But next year, the deer in those area that did survive from the disease and did get infected will have some viral immunity. And so we don't expect to see another big outbreak in the same area for repeated years. CWD, on the other hand, total different beast. It is always fatal to deer. It can stay in the environment, spread in the environment. And so once it's established, it's really hard to get rid of it. And you see it accumulating in prevalence and spreading to greater locations steadily over time, over many years.
That is, to me, a clear distinction. That first sign of frost, EHD, is over. But that is not the case for CWD.
Yeah, absolutely. There really isn't many, there's no cyclic checks and balances for CWD like that. It just keeps spreading once it's established.
How concerned is the state DNR about the spread of EHD?
Like I said, Definitely local areas, those landowners and hunters where it's happening right now, are going to see impacts to the deer population in the short term. Definitely feel for hunters that probably will see fewer deer in the landscapes, maybe significantly fewer through their fall season, and maybe have their opportunity to harvest deer impacted. But again, long-term population impacts are not anticipated when we look at other states where it happens more frequently, or some states that have had, really bad outbreaks. Even the next year, they see some deer density recovery. So, we're concerned for the hunter's experience. We're concerned for the landowners that are having to deal with the inconvenience of a lot of dead deer in the landscape and smell and nuisance. But in terms of a threat to our deer herd, we don't think. We don't believe that it's a long-term impact.
We're talking with Jasmine Batten, Wildlife Health Section Supervisor with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, as we look into EHD, epizootic hemorrhagic disease. Jasmine, what resources are there for hunters or property owners to dispose of these deer who die from EHD?
Yeah, disposal can be, unfortunately, pretty complicated. It's allowable to leave your carcasses where they're found. The carcass itself isn't going to continue to spread the virus. The virus doesn't impact humans, so that is a possibility depending on where the deer are. For folks that really want to or need to remove those carcasses, the best option is landfilling, although landfilling options can be limited based on where. What part of the state you're in and whether a landfill will accept carcasses. We do recommend that you reach out to your local municipalities. Some municipalities have resources, but otherwise you can even check with us just if you need some advice on safe disposal.
Before we move on, do you plan to do testing of carcasses and deer found outside of southeastern Wisconsin?
So our testing for EHD, really, the way that we do that, we track sick and dead wildlife reports from around the state. We have an online reporting form. We get emails and phone calls, and we really rely on homeowners, landowners, hunters to give us those reports because they're our eyes and ears on the ground, and it allows us to look for new trends emerging. In fact, that's how we were able to confirm this outbreak, as we saw at the early part of August a cluster of dead deer reports come from Washington County specifically. So if we are to see any increases in reports or suspicious dead deer activity out there, certainly we will go, we'll get some samples, and we'll test a few deer and confirm that that's what's happening. Once we know that a current outbreak is caused by EHD, we won't continue to sample the deer in those areas, but we will continue taking these reports, reviewing them, getting locations, cataloging, so that we can have a better idea of what the possible impacts are to the disease and how it's progressing.
All right, I want to move on now to CWD. Two captive deer and elk facilities in Wisconsin went under quarantine after recent detections of CWD in animals there. That's according to the Department of Agriculture. What do CWD numbers look like for this year?
We'd certainly expect that we will be seeing more positive deer this year. Unfortunately, the disease is fairly well established in some areas of the state. We continue to see new positives throughout the state, although the biggest number that we get really are in that southwest corner where the disease has existed the longest. We anticipate, probably similar in number of positives as last year, probably increased a little bit. Last year, we had a total of 2,040 CWD positive deer. So we're likely to see that number probably, unfortunately, a little bit increased as well.
We saw numbers that 60 of the state's 72 counties were considered CWD affected, according to state regulators last month. Are there any new strategies coming online that the DNR is using to combat the spread?
At this point, there's not a lot of new tools in the toolbox, so we continue to educate hunters, encourage them to properly dispose of their deer, because again, CWD can be spread through movement of deer carcasses and through the environment. We also have a number of most of the counties in the state have a baiting and feeding prohibition, so we really encourage hunters to follow those rules, even if they're in a county where feeding and baiting is allowed. They might consider voluntarily not using that practice because it can increase disease transmission amongst deer. And then really the most important thing is that hunters stay out there, keep hunting, keep harvesting deer to help manage healthy populations.
Why do we not see CWD as much in the northern reaches of the state? In some counties in northern Wisconsin, you don't see CWD.
Yeah, well, certainly, there could be areas in northern Wisconsin where it just has not been detected yet. So I have to give that disclaimer. It tends to persist at a very low prevalence initially, so it can take a while to detect, but we do test deer through the whole state. There's probably a number of reasons that it's less likely to be there or be as established. We have different landscape than Southwest Wisconsin. We have lower deer density populations. We have predators managing the population. So probably in the long term, just a little bit less hospitable for CWD spread, but that does not mean that it won't get there or that it can't get there. It really, really could show up at any really in anywhere in our state.
Jasmine, before we let you go, will the diseases we talked about, EHD and chronic wasting disease, have any impact on the overall size of the herd?
Well, with CWD, we have seen, particularly in the southwest part of the state where we have high prevalences, that it is impacting deer populations. Of course, we still have many, many deer. We still have high deer populations there, but over time, that population growth is declining and slowing. With EHD, very different story. In the short term, definitely. Fewer deer in Washington County this year. As we said, we've cataloged approaching 900 reports of suspected deer. Probably that number is much greater, as certainly that's just the number that we've received. But over the long term, those, that's a very robust deer population. It's got a lot of room, and those populations will recover.
Jasmine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for your interest. Good luck to all.
Jasmine Batten is Wildlife Health Section Supervisor at the Wisconsin DNR. The archery and crossbow hunting season gets underway Saturday. Coming up, a Wisconsin man was charged with possession and distribution of AI-generated child sexual images. A legal scholar breaks down a key decision from a federal court.
The ruling is that the First Amendment prohibits the prosecution of or the criminalization of simple possession of obscene material in the home.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This next conversation contains references to subject matter that some listeners might find disturbing. A federal court ruling is raising new legal questions about child sexual abuse material generated by people using AI applications. Last week, a three-judge panel ruled that the First Amendment protects a person's right to privately possess images or videos of child sexual abuse if the material does not depict a real person and remains in the home. The appeals court ruled in favor of a La Crosse County man who was criminally charged with using a popular AI image generator to create thousands of explicit images of children. His charge of possessing the materials was dismissed, but he still faces prosecution for distributing them. The ruling raises questions about the constitutionality of a 2024 Wisconsin state law that banned AI-generated child pornography. Ben Sobel is an assistant professor of law at the UW Law School. He spoke with Rob Ferret last week about the case and related issues.
All right, this gets a little complicated pretty quickly. The court ruled on a part of the case here, the possession of artificial intelligence-generated child sexual assault material here, the possession in particular. What did the court decide and what was their reasoning here?
Sure. So it's important to emphasize that we're dealing with a narrow ruling. It's by no means a get-out-of-jail-free card for the defendant. The ruling is that the First Amendment prohibits the prosecution of, or the criminalization of, simple possession of obscene material in the home.
Now, this, I think, may have surprised some people. This is imagery that depicts child sexual abuse and children in sexual situations. The distribution, this person is still going to be prosecuted for that. The creation of this material, I understand, could still be prosecuted. What was the reasoning for saying here that the possession of what I think most people would agree is disturbing material is not prosecutable?
Sure. The first thing to do is to clarify that we're not talking about media that records an actual offense against children that took place in real life, against an actual identifiable child. That material is not protected by the First Amendment. The possession of that material can be criminalized. Instead, we're dealing with purely AI-generated virtual child sexual abuse material. And the rationale here is that it's, you know, too intrusive under the First Amendment to reach into the home and regulate what a person, you know, what media a person may possess there. But as you say, that rationale does not extend to regulating what kind of material someone distributes or produces necessarily or receives.
Now, this AI issue is pretty new, but you wrote a paper on this a couple years back. It fits in existing case law, the idea that possession of outrageous material that people might have. Even before artificial intelligence, there was some case law on this. How does what happened before we were thinking about AI inform what we're thinking about now that this material exists?
Right. So the case that we're dealing with today follows pretty naturally from earlier Supreme Court case law suggesting that you can't have a statutory prohibition dealing on with virtual child sexual abuse material. That's a case called Free Speech Coalition against Ashcroft, and it's around 20 years old. Now, the question that we're confronted with now is whether technological conditions have changed such that we should revise the analysis. And so top of mind for the judges writing that opinion and for other commentators is, for example, whether hyper-realistic imagery that is a result of technical progress is now posing a different and greater challenge than the types of imagery that were at issue in past decisions years ago.
Now, before we dig further into that, this is a circuit court. This is something that could be appealed by federal prosecutors to the Supreme Court. They are likely, it seems like, to get prosecutions for distribution and things like that. Do you think if this does go to the Supreme Court, based on the arguments you've seen, would the U.S. Supreme Court back up this decision, knowing that we can't always predict what they're going to do?
It's hard to speculate, and I'm certainly not a court whisperer. I think one clue would be whether the Supreme Court takes the case at all. I think there is an appreciable chance that it does, but of course the Supreme Court has discretion over what cases it hears. I think that if it doesn't take the case, obviously that's an indication of where it was going to choose to let things lie. If it does take the case, that would suggest that it's maybe more inclined to revise the precedents that the case relies on. That's sort of the best predictor I can have, but predictions are hard.
Now, in Congress and in state legislatures, including here in Wisconsin, lawmakers are worried about this kind of material. Laws have been passed, including here in Wisconsin. Do you see this decision putting those laws in jeopardy in their current forms?
Again, it's worth emphasizing again the narrowness of the present decision, really only concerning private possession of this material. So only insofar as, for example, state legislation prohibits that, is there a constitutional problem under the reasoning of this case. And so there remain many avenues for addressing this material that are outside the reasoning of this case.
Now, possession of this material, well, now if somebody's using some kind of AI, I think in this case it was a text-to-image generator, they're creating this material. Does production fall into a different category than possession?
Right. So here, the analysis of the district court judge sitting here in Madison is illustrative. And so this judge, actually, if my reading of Wikipedia is correct, Judge Peterson has, I think, a PhD in film studies and was a film studies professor, so kind of uniquely qualified to examine some of the issues that this type of media presents. And that judge declined to say that this First Amendment protection extended to the production count. And that's not without some, you know, without observing some tension. The tension is, of course, if you are free under the First Amendment to possess obscene media, then presumably you couldn't say that it's illegal to draw an obscene drawing in the privacy of your home. Yet, I think understanding that we're dealing with a different technology and a really limited precedent from the Supreme Court, the district judge in this case declined to extend it to cover production.
And how about at the circuit court level then? Where is that part of this in the process, the production as opposed to possession?
Yeah, the production, there's no, at this point,
That's prosecutable.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, part of the production in this case is which AI company and their software that was used to produce this. Is there a thought that if a user uses a company's AI bot or chatbot or whatever to produce this material, that that company could be liable or prosecutable in some way?
Right. This is a notable case because, as I recall, it involved a program called Stable Diffusion, which is an open source image generator. And so that means that it's sort of much harder to control how it is used. So companies that have tighter control over their applications may impose more safeguards that prevent generating this kind of media. In contrast, something like Stable Diffusion, harder to regulate, harder to control the sorts of stuff that it produces or that people can tweak it to produce. One very important point on this precise angle: it was reported in, I want to say, late 2023 that some of the training data, and we're talking about billions of images, but among those billions of images for some of Stable Diffusion's training data were child sexual abuse images. And so while that issue wasn't implicated by this particular case, that is an additional wrinkle in this really complicated landscape of regulating both the technology itself and the images that it's capable of producing.
Now, an issue that's come up, and again, this is in your paper a couple of years back, there's been a debate over a depiction of an actual person using deepfakes. We're talking about adults in that case. Is there potentially a difference of the person creating child sexual abuse material with AI representing an actual child in particular and a resemblance to that child versus, I guess, a generic image of a child?
Yes, that's an absolutely a different issue here. So the appellate court in this case noted that the government conceded that we're not dealing with something that depicts an identifiable child or is even linked to one. Now, I would question whether that's actually true in the sense that I'm sure that there are images of children. There may even be sexual abuse images in the data that trained this model. But nevertheless, that's the sort of facts that we're accepting for the purposes of this case. That says nothing about depictions of particular identifiable individuals, whether they're adults or children.
We're talking about a federal court ruling on AI-generated child sexual abuse material. The legal implications for a Wisconsin law banning it, our guest is UW Law School Assistant Professor Ben Sobel. Attorneys general around the country very interested in this issue. If nothing else, they are seeing a lot more reports of material. And then they have to evaluate if this court ruling stands, if they're looking at possession, is this material actual imagery of actual children, or is it AI-generated imagery of fictitious children? That may be a very important legal distinction. How do they try to make that distinction to know this is prosecutable, this is not?
Right. So, you know, The particulars of that are you know, probably better directed to someone with more like forensic experience than me. What I can say is that there are a few different concerns here that are worth disentangling. So one is the concern that that the proliferation of this hyper-realistic media will overrun existing infrastructure for identifying and reporting child sexual abuse, so tip lines and stuff. And it does seem like that infrastructure is really strained under this flood of new imagery. A separate question is whether this kind of imagery makes it more difficult to prove cases against defendants for possession of actual depictions of child sexual abuse. That was forecasted around the time of that Supreme Court case I mentioned about 20 years ago, and it did not come to pass. It may be different as the technology gets more and more realistic. A final third point, or a third harm worth identifying, is separate from how this type of media complicates prosecution or complicates efforts to identify abuse in the first instance, is the question of prohibiting it simply because it's believed to be antisocial and wrong, regardless of the effects that it has on those other things. So there are many different debates going on. The third one is about obscenity and sort of public decency and the appropriate media for people to consume and possess. That's distinct from efforts to preserve existing prosecution frameworks and abuse identification frameworks.
Looking at the law as it stands here in Wisconsin, do you think lawmakers should be revisiting our laws in light of this court decision?
I don't think that this court decision is an obstacle to enforcing the law on the Wisconsin books, except insofar as it pertains to private possession in the home. And I'll end my answer there. Yeah.
Is there an avenue to regulate AI companies, AI providers, and say, you have to make sure that your systems can't be used to produce this kind of material, even if ultimately we say possession by that individual is not prosecutable? We could have a law that would pass a First Amendment test that says you could be prosecuted if you don't have safeguards in your tools to make sure people can't use it for this.
Well, the first thing I'll say is that I think most companies have a pretty strong incentive to ensure that their tools don't behave like this in the first instance. And so I believe that they almost certainly have those kinds of safeguards in place just on their own volition. If we're dealing with media that is obscene, is not protected by the First Amendment, then I think that there's less of a problem. If you're dealing with rules that would restrict what sorts of constitutionally protected media AI could generate, that might be more problematic. But since the statutes at issue here, whether the Wisconsin one or the federal one, are limited to obscene media, I think that's less worrisome.
Okay. We know the big name AI companies, and as you said, they have a powerful incentive to try to not have their names attached to this kind of material. A group of hackers in Moscow, China, wherever in the world, don't have that disincentive necessarily. They want to put out what they want to the world, and then there's no walls really in the internet. Is there a way to regulate that sort of open source software to make sure people can't use it for this kind of material?
Right. I think that remains a more difficult problem, particularly if you're dealing with people, like in your example, that are outside of the jurisdiction of the United States. And so I think the answer is that we would face a similar problem that is faced with the enforcement of child sexual abuse laws more generally, which is that there may be wrongdoers outside of the reach of U.S. law enforcement.
Now, you could tell I'm a little overwhelmed by the complexity of the First Amendment case law on this, the technology itself. Is there an aspect of this that I haven't even brought up, right, that you think is important that people, lawmakers and others, be thinking about on these issues?
I think it's worth emphasizing, again, the narrowness of the ruling that we're dealing with. And I also think it's worth disentangling the sorts of arguments that are being made. And of course, it is the job of lawyers to muster as many different arguments that are compelling in favor of their position. But the arguments in favor of regulating this material, because it leads to downstream harms, for example, facilitating the grooming of children or encouraging people to commit sexual abuse crimes. Those are different from regulating the media in itself because it is obscene and thus harmful. And so I think when drafting legislation or considering policy or making these arguments, it is always helpful to disentangle those distinct sorts of claims, which may have distinct, receive distinct legal treatment and are to in varying degrees empirical questions versus sort of moral and social questions.
And so, for example, if someone were to use this kind of material that they generated to blackmail a teen, say, into some kind of behavior, that is illegal already. So that doesn't necessarily lead into the core of this issue.
Indeed, and in this case, there is already there was a distribution of obscene media to a minor charge there. And so, if the concern is that children in particular shouldn't have access to this material, well, yes, there is a law for addressing that. And indeed, as you suggest, we have laws like blackmail that prohibit blackmail. And of course, that's distinct from a law that prohibits virtual child sexual abuse material because it in itself is obscene.
Okay, so this is going to be working its way through the courts, through legislatures, and the technology is going to keep changing. What are you watching most closely now? What is the next development you have your eye on?
I think that we'll be very curious to see whether, for example, the Seventh Circuit rehears this case with a fuller complement of the court, whether the Supreme Court takes this case. And I think that's for the moment what I really have my eye on. For further, keeping tabs on how defendants in these cases assert defenses and whether they succeed will also be important. So measuring whether it's in fact true that prosecutions are failing because the prosecution is unable to prove that the images aren't virtual or things like that will be an important matter to keep tabs on as we assess the consequences of this developing technology.
Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Ben Sobel, an assistant professor of law at the UW Law School, talking with Rob Ferret. He was with us to discuss a federal court ruling on the First Amendment rights around AI-generated child pornography and what it means for a Wisconsin law that bans those materials. Coming up, the Wisconsin Mental Health Warrior Film Fest is set for this weekend. Meet a filmmaker and the event organizer who give a glimpse into complex themes.
Being able to tell stories about mental health, trauma, triumph, and some of these films also have a sense of humor, a sense of lightness.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. September is Suicide Awareness Month, and this weekend kicks off the third ever Mental Health Warrior Film Festival in Madison. The festival will feature independent films from around the world that explore topics related to mental health. Some of those films are from right here in Wisconsin. Headlining the festival is Afterglow. It's a documentary about a group of parkour athletes from Beloit that explores trauma, belonging, and the power of movement and community.
When it comes to mental health and as Siegfried and as a family, Nathan is kind of a champion in that and inspires a lot of people to like look after that. That's why we really love like the adventures and the exploration, is that it's not so much as like being somewhere you're not supposed to be, but maybe finding those areas inside yourself where some part of you is convinced that you're not supposed to be there either.
Max Blaska is a filmmaker and director of the NAMI Wisconsin Mental Health Warrior Film Festival. And Nathan Sill is a filmmaker and parkour athlete from Beloit. He's the writer and director of Afterglow. They talked with Rob Ferret last week.
Max, what inspired you to create this film festival dedicated to mental health?
Well, I've struggled with severe anxiety, depression, suicidation most of my life. 4 years ago, it was so bad, I actually had to commit myself in Miramont Mental Health. And I got a great opportunity to make my own film, Last Rung of the Ladder. It was Stephen King, one of his Dollar Baby programs, one of the last. And just the community that I found with Jeff Blankenship, Kurt, my co-writers, the crew, everything, I felt like I belonged and I felt like a creative purpose. And I truly believe that a creative purpose is as important in as in medication and therapy and prayer. And so I went to a couple film festivals and I kind of thought, I want to create my own. And there's only about maybe four or five mental health themed film festivals in America. And I've been to like three of them. And I wanted to bring my own. And this is the third one we're having. I learned the mistake. Do not have it in May. The weather is too nice in May to have a film festival. And so instead, it's September for Suicide Prevention Awareness Month.
And this is the Mental Health Warrior Film Festival. Why that particular theme?
Because you hear, oh, he's a mental health survivor. He struggles with mental health issues, blah, 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 blah. I like warrior because we are warriors. We are fighters. And we fight demons and we fight metaphorical thoughts in our head. Like, for example, just writing an email to you guys, I agonized over it. Said, you're going to do something wrong. You're going to embarrass yourself. You're going to piss them off. And everything's going to fall apart. But I pushed through it. And look, I'm like having this. And
you're here.
Yeah.
Now, the community you mentioned in filmmaking, and I imagine in pulling together a film festival, talk a little more about the value of that for your mental health, finding those people, maybe kindred spirits in creativity and maybe in mental health warrior status.
Oh, yes. And the thing is, one thing, going to all these film festivals all across states, every state has their own center of filmmakers. And it's a community, and the mental illness wants you to be alone. Because when you're at home, just in bed, doing nothing, the mental health wins. Anxiety and depression tries to protect you. It's kind of like a clinging, over-abusive boyfriend that wants you all to himself. But the thing is, you have to learn to kind of say, no, I'm doing this. I know what's right. And being able to tell stories about mental health, trauma, triumph. And some of these films also have a sense of humor, a sense of lightness. And we have some great documentaries. We have some great animated shorts. One of my favorite films is called The Reason from New Jersey, about a suicidal man who goes to a pawn shop to buy a gun, and the pawn shop owner gives him a cookbook. It's a really good movie, and we're international. We have films screening at Flix Brewhouse from Argentina, from Singapore, from Jamaica. We actually have a filmmaker who is coming from Jamaica to attend the film festival and to do a Q&A.
Well, let's meet one of the directors now and stars of a documentary. Nathan Sell, we mentioned just a moment ago, you directed Afterglow, the documentary. It's you and friends during parkour, and it's a lot more than that. Tell us a little bit about what went into Afterglow.
Yeah, Afterglow, I think, is a passion project that it literally is 22 years of our life. When we filmed it, we went into the process. We had always wanted to make something. What that was, we didn't quite know. We grew up watching a lot of YouTube where we watched parkour like start taking its running start from, and a lot of parkour is spread through social media. And we, my senior year of college, we had decided that I really wanted to do a road trip. I thought that would be super fun. We could go revisit all these locations from the last 10 years that we had been going to since high school. I thought it would be nice as a graduation for all of us who had, you know, gone through so much. As that progressed, we decided that we wanted to make a film out of it because, again, inspired from YouTube, inspired by social media, we thought that would be such a fun celebration of what we had all gone through. And I think from there, it really just became, we realized how deeply tied mental health, our friendship, the community we had built was like the backbone of our film. And it became less about the parkour and more about how movement in general and the community we had built started, had affected us. It changed us as people for the best.
And there's a part of the documentary that really gets into what you and Max have been saying here about the risk of isolation and the value of connection. You look back at a time when you'd had an injury that got aggravated. You end up with surgery. Pick up the story from there.
Yeah. That was my freshman year of
college, and the COVID epidemic was just starting. So I went into surgery up here in Madison, actually, and there was a little bit of a hiccup in the surgery. So when I woke up, I could not feel the bottom part of my torso. I couldn't move my legs, and I was told I might be paralyzed for the rest of my life. In that moment, I think, when you're on a lot of medication, so it feels very surreal. But then putting COVID on top of that, where no one can visit you in the hospital, no one can visit you when you're transported to a rehabilitation clinic, it really, I think, stresses how important community was, because it was a very dark time, and I think it only got darker knowing that, like, well, not knowing, but feeling that there wasn't anyone there with me at that time.
And so you're at risk of being paralyzed for the rest of your life. The thing that you did for community leading up to this, right, is parkour, this incredibly active thing with this group of friends. So you're worried about the loss of walking, the loss of parkour, and I think the loss of this community that you'd built around parkour. But everybody in the movie starts reviewing their text messages from that time. How did you start to emerge and reconnect with the guys?
Absolutely. So I think one of the most heartening things from the whole experience was that when I came back, when I was finally out of rehab, even though we were separated by glass or masks or things, just to, you know, safety precautions for COVID, people were still coming and visiting. Evan and Devin came over like every other weekend to say hi. Max came over every weekend to say hi. And it was just like a really nice, amazing like experience to know that people are there for you in your like darkest time. I think you don't realize how lucky you are until you're put in a situation like that. And it was these relationships I hadn't necessarily taken for granted, but I hadn't fully noticed how much they were doing for me in my own life until I was put in a situation where I had to fully rely on them for the emotional support that I was missing.
Now, Max, let's bring you back in here. There was a time not that long ago where I think the assumption was if you had a mental health problem, you might not talk to your friends and family about it, and you certainly wouldn't talk publicly about it, maybe share it in a movie. I feel like that's been changing over the last 10, 15 years,
yes.
And the film festival is part of that. What is the value, as you see it, of people sharing these stories with their friends and with the world?
It's one, getting your story out, but it's also empathy. It's your heart is touched more when you see a narrative or a very interesting documentary rather than just seeing a report on the news. One of the films is Turn My Bleep Bleep Mind Off, about a former hockey player, Clint Markachuk, who dealt with PTSD and talks about the dealing with mental health in a hyper-masculine world of NHL hockey. And we get conversations, and the stigma is less. And the thing is, NAMI Wisconsin has been fighting stigma for more than 50 years now. And this is the first year that the Mental Health Warrior Film Festival is a NAMI Wisconsin event. So many other film festivals, the money raises for the film festival itself. I'm not getting any of the money. All the money is going to NAMI Wisconsin. And we are selling. We also learned something from last year. Instead of having a whole block where you do the whole day, we're also selling them in two blocks, an afternoon and an evening block, of two 90-minute screenings each. And so then if you can only come in the afternoon from 1 to 4:30, you can do that. If you can only come to the evening from 5:30 to 10, you can do that. But the cool thing is you won't miss any of the films, because buying a ticket, you get access to the digital library that'll be online on Eventive from the 13th through the end of the month. And we have even more films, because there were so many films that we couldn't screen all the ones on the big screen, that you can see as well. And I wanted to let you know, I just talked to NAMI in Mississippi, New York, and Georgia. I'm going to do some more tomorrow. And they're on board. They're going to advertise. They're going to market it.
Oh, wow.
Going to do a press release thing to all the cities where the filmmakers are. I'm only talking the states where the filmmakers are. Because I want to make sure that these filmmakers, because they're all, like I said, from 15 states and 5 countries, I want to make sure that they get their spotlight. Because this is not about me. Yes, I'm the creator, I'm the founder, but it's about the art and about the filmmakers themselves. And we are having filmmakers coming from, I think, 6 films, including Afterglow, and we're going to have Q&As.
And Nathan, picking up on something Max mentioned about masculinity and being willing to talk about mental health, you actually kind of allude to that in the documentary, and some of your friends do too. You want to be strong, right? You're doing this very vigorous activity of parkour. You don't necessarily want to admit weakness. How did you overcome that?
I think that the biggest thing that we learned with masculinity with our own friend group is that we weren't getting anywhere by not holding each other accountable in our everyday life. A lot of us struggle with what it means to be a man in like the concept of masculinity in today's world. But there isn't really anything that's strong about holding those toxic emotions in. It's by talking and working together and relying on other people that I think true strength is found. And I think that's a lesson that we've all learned because we've all been in very dark places and we got nowhere by ourselves. We got nowhere holding all that emotion in, pushing it down. It was only when we opened up, started communicating, started asking for help, started using the resources around us that we actually started becoming the people that we could look in the mirror and be happy with.
And Max, as you're selecting movies, is that the kind of message you were looking for, that portraying people being able to reach out, work with other people? It's not magical solutions here, but a part of the process.
No, and the thing is, I just realized something. We have three great documentaries. Afterglow, Turn My Mind Off, and Nasty, which is, I couldn't do it on screen, but I wanted to catch it, by John Jelski, which is about a 9/11 pilot and the PTSD and depression after that, and how after he passed, friends got together to make a tribute for him. And it just, I didn't realize, but the three documentaries, the thing they have in common is mental health in a masculine world, NHL hockey, sport of parkour, and the military. And I didn't figure that out until just now.
Amazing. Nathan, what is next for you as a filmmaker or as somebody working in the mental health world?
Yeah, film is paused for me at the moment. I'm very happy with Afterglow, and we're seeing where it goes. We love sharing the movie, the message, and we're so thankful to have an amazing mental health film festival here in Wisconsin. Looking through Film Freeway, I came across it, and I was just so excited to see it. I was like, this is one of the coolest things that I could have found that day. And in my everyday life, one of my friends, Devin, who's one of the co-leads in the movie, he and I are working at our county's crisis unit, crisis intervention. It is a very humbling experience, but it is great to be able to help people navigate a very tough system. I know that for myself, I wish I knew about the resources that are out there before I got to a breaking point. And so being able to help people who call in to navigate that is a really amazing opportunity to do.
And Max, I know you have your eye on this year's festival, but are you looking for a return in 2027?
What I would love to do is to actually work with these nominees and have a multi-city film festival.
Wow.
In person, four cities, regional, and you'll show the films and tailor it so it'll make easier to filmmakers to come up. But another dream that I really have that I'm going to work out right after this is done is have an idea of a concert album, a concert with musicians, both professional and amateur, singing covers of the songs that got them through high school to help raise awareness for teenage suicide prevention programs.
Amazing. Max, thanks so much for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And Nathan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Max Blaska is a filmmaker and director of the NAMI Wisconsin Mental Health Warrior Film Festival. And Nathan Sill is a filmmaker and parkour athlete from Beloit. He's the writer and director of Afterglow, which is headlining the festival. They spoke with Rob Ferret. The film festival is set for Saturday at Flicks Brewhouse in Madison. For tickets and info, you can go to namiwisconsin.org. That's namiwisconsin.org. If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health emergency, call or text the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. It provides free and confidential support 24/7. We talked with a supper club guru who has visited hundreds of them all over the state. And Jill in Madison wrote in to share a memory. When I was growing up, a favorite place for a nice dinner with my grandparents and extended family was Dave's Supper Club in Owen, Wisconsin. Jill says, sadly, it's no longer in business, but I can remember the kitty cocktail I was allowed to have, how my grandmother always ordered the fried shrimp, which came with melted butter held in a small cup over a small flame, and the amazing salad bar. Jill goes on to say, of course, we enjoyed the relish tray. Grandma would eat the green onions and the breadsticks that were always on the table. There was usually a grasshopper at the end of the meal. This place cemented my vision of what a true Wisconsin supper club should be. Jill, thanks so much for sharing that memory. Let's hear more of these. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Lauren Cox, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.